ago, it envisioned giving cities, particularly those in colder climates that may not host a future Super Bowl, a chance to have a signature event that would have a lot of benefits, including an economic impact. Chicago was the first tourist stop in 2015, and it generated $81 million for the community. Kansas City had it last year, sparking $164 million in economic impact. Another opportunity for our franchise and our city, and just for the world, to kind of migrate to downtown Detroit, said Lions General Manager Brad Holmes, who has turned around a franchise that is coming off its best season since winning the 1957 NFL title. I expect it to be pretty packed. I'm excited for all the businesses. Detroit's draft is expected to bring in at least $160 million, giving small businesses a boost from fans flocking in and around campus Martius Park. One longtime business is looking forward to more than just an increase in foot traffic. Lauren Stovall, the business lead at Hot Sam's, and two others representing the 103-year-old men's clothing store and tailor shop will be on stage during the draft's final day Saturday. There's a perception of Detroit that comes from people who actually have not been here, Stovall said. What's so great is when people actually come to Detroit, they are blown away because Detroit is not what they thought it might have been. And that's it for the sports for today. I'm Bill Murphy. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend, everybody, and please stay safe.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
It's Friday, April 26th, 2024. I'm Charlie Shine, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant and the New York Times with me today is Bill Murphy. We're going to start by taking a look at the pictures on the front page of the New York Times and then jump over to Bill. He's going to show us the pictures on the front page of the Courant and give us our first story. So on the front page of the Times, there's a 3x5 photo. In the upper left-hand side, the caption, "Welcome to Venice." That'll be €5, please. Venice's first day of charging a fee to enter the historic center went mostly smoothly, but some protests and polemics. We're going to actually take a look at that. That's in the middle of the paper. And then as we move on over, we have a picture of Justice Neil Gorsuch. He says, "We're writing a rule for the ages. The story itself, split court, hints at some immunity for ex-presidents." And yes, we are going to take a closer look at that in just a little bit. As we move on down, we have a photo of kids in a lunch line. The story itself and the caption, "Changes to federal regulations on school meals have administrators worried about wastes and costs." And we're going to be covering that in a little bit. As we move on down, we find the thumbnail photos in the bottom of the page from the national section. "A crackdown on coal. The new EPA rules could spell the end for the fossil fuel that powered the country for more than a century." And the picture looks like a energy factory, electricity factory, with coal stacks and smoke billowing out. Moving over to the right, we have from the business section, "Southwest to cut costs. The airline expects fewer deliveries of Boeing planes and cited challenges in achieving growth plans." The photo itself is a fleet of looks like grounded Boeing planes sitting on a tarmac. And the final photo from the weekend arts section, taking aim at bullets in a new exhibition at the Gagosian Gallery in Manhattan. The Italian artist Maurizio Cattelan confronts gun violence in the United States. And the photo itself, it looks like a picture of the artist sitting down, staring at the camera. Not quite sure what that has to do with bullets, but what do I know about art? Anyway, we're going to go over to Bill and get our first story over there, and also the pictures on the front page of the Current. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Charlie. A very simple picture, a picture of a sign outside of a gas station, giving the price of gas at that gas station, $3.69 for regular gas. Caption says the price of unleaded gas at the Gulf Station Thursday in Portland is $3.69. That's where this picture is taking place. And underneath that, again, I'll read a caption. It says the price of regular gas in Connecticut has jumped 16% since the beginning of the year. On Wednesday, the average was $3.71. And there's a picture of Connecticut, a small picture, and there's 8 different cities mentioned: Litchfield, Hartford, Tyland, Windham, New London, Middlesex, New Haven, and Fairfield, giving the prices of gas in that town. And we are going to have that story. I think it's going to be right before we get to the weather. But the first story I have is from the World of Nations section of the Current from Washington. Coal-fired power plants would be forced to capture smokestack emissions or shut down under a rule issued Thursday by the Environmental Protection Agency, that's the EPA. New limits on greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel-fired electric plants are the Biden administration's most ambitious effort yet to roll back planet-warming pollution from the power sector, the nation's second largest contributor to climate change. The rules are a key part of President Joe Biden's pledge to eliminate carbon pollution from the electricity sector by 2035 and across the economy by 2050. The rule was among four measures targeting coal and natural gas plants that the EPA said would provide regulatory certainty to the power industry and encourage them to make investments to transition to a clean energy economy. The measures include requirements to reduce toxic wastewater pollutants from coal-fired plants and safely manage coal ash in unlined storage ponds. EPA Administrator Michael Regan said the rules will reduce pollution and improve public health while supporting the reliable long-term supply of electricity that America needs. One of the biggest environmental challenges facing our nation is man-made pollution that damages our air, our water, and our land, Regan said in a speech at Howard University. Not only is this pollution a major threat to public health, it's pushing our planet to the brink. Regan called the power plant rules a defining moment for his agency as it works to build a cleaner and healthier future for all of us. The plan is likely to be challenged by industry groups and Republican-leaning states. They have repeatedly accused the Democratic administration of overreach on environmental regulations and have warned of a looming reliability crisis for the electric grid. The rules issued Thursday are among at least half dozen EPA rules limiting power plant emissions and wastewater pollution. Environmental groups hailed the EPA's latest action as urgently needed to protect against the devastating harms of climate change. The power plant rule marks the first time the federal government has restricted carbon dioxide emissions from existing coal-fired power plants. The rule also would force future electric plants fueled by coal or gas to control up to 90% of their carbon pollution. The new standards will avoid 1.38 billion metric tons of carbon pollution through 2047, equivalent to the annual emissions of 328 million gas cars, the EPA said, and it will provide hundreds of billions of dollars in climate and health benefits measured in fewer premature deaths, asthma cases, and lost work or school days. Coal plants that plan to stay open beyond 2039 would have to cut or capture 90% of their carbon dioxide emissions by 2032. The EPA said plants that expect to retire by 2039 would face a less stringent standard, but still would have to capture some emissions. Coal plants set to retire by 2032 would not be subject to the new rules. And over to Charlie.
The small Ukraine hilltop town that is Russia's next big target. Zelensky says Kremlin is hoping to capture Chasiv Yar by May 9th. Russian forces have razed dozens of towns and cities in Ukraine over the past 26 months, killing thousands of civilians and forcing millions of them from their homes, leaving a trail of destruction that is impossible to calculate. Severodonetsk, Bakhmut, Avdiivka, cities and towns little known to the world, have been become these scorched earth battlegrounds where two armies clashed for months to bloody effect before the Russians finally prevailed. Now, Russian forces have set their sights on Chasiv Yar, a hilltop fortress town in eastern Ukraine. The campaign is part of an intense effort by Russia to achieve what could be its most operationally significant advance since the first summer of the war in 2022. Chasiv Yar covers only about 5 square miles, but if the Russians can seize it, they will control commanding heights that will allow them to directly target the main agglomeration of cities still under Kyiv's control in the Donetsk region. That includes the headquarters of the Ukrainian Eastern Command in Kramatorsk. It would also... I apologize if I'm seriously mispronouncing these. It would also put Russian troops within 10 miles of Kostanivka, the main supply juncture for Ukrainian forces across much of the Eastern Front. Chasiv Yar is the key that will open the gate for exhaustive and long-lasting battles, said Serhiy Habrowski, a military analyst who's a former colonel in the Ukrainian army. While Ukraine hopes renewed military assistance from the U.S. will allow it to start stabilizing fraying defensive lines, its soldiers are desperately short of just about everything, from artillery shells and tank rounds to air defenses and armored vehicles. It could take weeks for significant flows of materiel to change the dynamic on the front, and Ukrainian officials have warned that the Kremlin will try to exploit this window of opportunity to target Ukrainian defenses wherever it can. Just this week, Russian forces exploited a gap in Ukrainian defenses outside of Avdiivka to advance about 2 miles on the village of Ocheretani, which is 30 miles south of Chasiv Yar, according to the Ukrainian military. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. This story from New York, it's in the World of Nations section. As Donald Trump was running for president in 2016, his old friend at the National Enquirer was scooping up potentially damaging stories about the candidate and paying out tens of thousands of dollars to keep them from the public eye. But when it came to the seamy claims by porn performer Stormy Daniels, David Pecker said he put his foot down. "I am not paying for this story," he told jurors Thursday at Trump's hush money trial, recounting his version of a conversation with Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, about the catch-and-kill scheme that prosecutors alleged amounted to interference in the race. Pecker was already $180,000 in the hole on other Trump-related stories by the time Daniels came along. "I didn't want to be involved in this from the beginning." Pecker's testimony was a critical building block for the prosecution's theory that their partnership was a way to illegally influence the 2016 presidential election. The Manhattan District Attorney is seeking to elevate the gravity of the history-making first trial of a former American president and the first of 4 criminal cases against Trump to reach a jury. But the hush money trial was just one of the consequential legal matters facing the Republican presidential candidate Thursday. The U.S. Supreme Court also heard arguments over whether Trump should be immune from prosecution in a federal case over his efforts to reverse his 2020 election loss to Joe Biden. Trump's many legal problems were colliding this week. The hush money case includes a looming decision on whether he violated a gag order and should be held in contempt. His former lawyers and associates were indicted in a 2020 election-related scheme in Arizona, and a New York judge rejected a request for a new trial in a defamation case that found Trump liable for $83.3 million in damages. Trump has maintained he is not guilty of any of the charges, and as well that the stories were bought and swells were false.
And continuing with the international section of the New York Times, issues testing the thaw between U.S. and China. Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken is meeting officials in China this week as disputes over wars, trade, technology, and security are testing the two countries' efforts to stabilize the relationship. The United States is heading into an election year which President Biden will face pressure to confront Chinese authoritarian government and other new protections for American businesses and workers from low-priced Chinese imports. China is courting foreign investment to help its sluggish economy. At the same time, its leader, Xi Jinping, has been bolstering national security and expanding China's military footprint around Taiwan and the South China Sea in ways that have alarmed its neighbors. Mr. Biden and Mr. Xi have held talks to prevent their country's disputes from spiraling into conflict after relations sank to their lowest point in decades last year. But an array of challenges could make steadying the relationship difficult. Among them, China's territory claims. The United States has been pushing back against China's increasingly assertive claims over swaths of the South China Sea and the self-governed island of Taiwan by building security alliances in Asia. The effort has prompted more concerns in Beijing that the United States is leading a campaign to encircle China and contain its rise. In meetings earlier this month, Mr. Biden met with the leaders of Japan and the Philippines. They discussed territorial conflicts in the South China Sea, including China's repeated harassment of lawful Philippine operations, the U.S. government said. Encounters between Chinese and American military ships and planes in the Taiwan Strait and the South China and East China Seas have continued, raising concerns that an accident could trigger a confrontation between the two powers. That is why U.S. officials have insisted on maintaining close military communication. High-level contacts between the two armies were restored earlier this year after China froze communications in response to former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan in August 2022. China says that the United States and its allies are stoking confrontation and should not interfere in the region's affairs. It has already bristled about the United States and the Philippines launching annual joint military exercises this week. The U.S. Army also deployed for the first time as part of an exercise a mid-range missile system in the Philippines that could reach targets in China. To counter Washington's efforts, China has been trying to shore up its ties with non-aligned countries in the region. The country's top diplomat, Wang Yi, visited Indonesia, Cambodia, and Papua New Guinea last week, around the same time that Mr. Blinken met with foreign ministers from the Group of Seven Nations, a grouping Beijing considers a rival for global influence. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. Pain at the pump. This story on the front page of the Hartford Courant. Gas prices in Connecticut jumped nearly 30 cents a gallon in the last month, 20 cents in the last week alone. Little more than a month away from the long Memorial Day holiday, the traditional start of the summer driving season. Relief may be on the way as crude oil prices, which account for half of the price paid at the pump, ease, and tensions over a wider war in the Middle East expanding to Israel and Iran appear to be calming. But experts warn that gas prices in Connecticut could see a mid to late summer spike, particularly if what could be the busiest hurricane season on record knocks out refineries along the Gulf Coast, which are heavy suppliers to the Northeast. It's a roller coaster, I think, said Tom Kloza, global head of energy analysis at the Oil Price Information Service, a gas and oil price reporting agency in Rockville, Maryland. The greatest chance for a dip is between now and the middle of July, and then I think it is back up to the roller coaster, log, flume, or whatever you want to call it. Gas prices are still climbing in Connecticut this spring, according to AAA, the Auto and Travel Group. The average price for a gallon of regular gas in Connecticut was $3.71 as of Wednesday, a fraction of a penny increase from Tuesday and up from $3.53 a week ago. At the same time, a year ago, the price per gallon was $3.59. The price of regular gas in Connecticut on Wednesday was 5 cents a gallon higher than the national average of $3.66, according to AAA. In Hartford County, the average was $3.69. Better grades of gas, mid-grade and premium, are averaging well over $4 a gallon, which each gaining a penny between Tuesday and Wednesday. The price per gallon for regular gas, the cheapest and most popular choice among motorists, has risen 51 cents, or 16%, since the beginning of 2024, AAA reported. Analysts say it is not unusual for gas prices to climb in the spring, and they typically moderate after the Memorial Day holiday. Since 2005, prices at the pump have risen annually in the first half of the year, with one notable exception, 2020, when the pandemic shut down travel on the roads, according to Bespoke Investment Group in Harrison, New York, which analyzes economic trends for its investors. It is approximately 19 minutes past the top of the hour, and that means it's time for the weather. Charlie's going to give us the national forecast from the New York Times, and I'll give you the local weather after that.
For helpful tips on using assistive computer technology, listen Monday afternoons at 2 for the Keystrokes Computer Hour on Chris.
Thank you, Bill. National forecast from the New York Times. Thunderstorms with torrential downpours, large hail, damaging wind gusts, and tornadoes will erupt from Minnesota to northeastern Texas today, with the greatest threat for strong tornadoes in Iowa and Missouri. Further north, occasional rain will fall in an arc from central South Dakota through Minnesota and into Wisconsin. Thundershowers will pepper much of Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado. Periods of rain are expected in portions of Washington and Oregon and as far south as northwestern California. Meanwhile, strong winds and dry conditions could lead to an elevated fire risk and blowing dust in the panhandles of Oklahoma and Texas. Gusty winds, low humidity, and dry brush will result in fire risk in southeastern Colorado and eastern New Mexico.
And the local forecast for today through Sunday night, patchy frost before 8 a.m., otherwise sunny with a high near 62. Tonight, clear with a low around 37. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 65. Saturday night, a chance of showers mainly after 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 43. Sunday, a slight chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a high near 68. And Sunday night, mostly cloudy, with a low around 52.
Taking a look at the front page of the New York Times, lunchtime debate waged in sodium and sugar. From Haleysville, Alabama, around 11:40 on a cold spring day in early April, students began to stream into the lunchroom at Haleysville High School in Alabama. Cheerleaders, soccer and baseball players, and other members of the student body filed through the lunch line, sat at their tables. They chatted and laughed about upcoming games, Go Roaring Lions, and at prom as they dug into plates of chicken Alfredo, green beans, and salad. Emma Ann Holman, standing in a corner, watched the teenagers carefully. As the child nutrition director for the Haleysville City School District, she has a job of feeding 1,600 students in pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. For months, Ms. Holman and the other heads of the school lunch programs had worried about new federal regulations that would reduce allowable sodium levels and introduce new sugar restrictions for foods served in school cafeterias. A debate has raged, with many parents and nutritionists applauding efforts to make lunches more nutritious, while some school administrators fretted that the result will be less tasty to students, reducing consumption and increasing waste. We are cringing as it could result in changes across our menus, Ms. Hallman said. We would have to look at the sodium amounts in the recipes and some of our students' favorite foods like chicken wings, hot wings, or even some of the Asian foods. The job of feeding the nation's school children has never been easy, but in recent years, it has become particularly difficult. Rapid inflation has made it harder for schools to prepare meals at or below the cost of $4.30 per student, the reimbursement level for the roughly 30 million students who receive federally subsidized meals. Meanwhile, competition for labor has resulted in higher wages, putting a strain on lunch program budgets and shortages of employees in some cafeterias. I can't compete with what Amazon is paying, said Betty Wiggins, the head of nutrition services for the Houston Independent School District, one of the nation's largest school districts, which serves over 200,000 meals a day across 276 locations. Likening her program to a quick service restaurant with the annual revenue of $132 million, Ms. Wiggins, about 35% of her budget, said went to labor costs and half to food. I've got to pay for all of that with a budget of $4.30 per student, and I have some food manufacturers backing out, saying they can't make the food at that cost anymore, she said. While far from perfect, cafeterias serve plenty of processed food, school lunches are arguably much healthier than they were a few years ago, thanks to a signature program geared towards combating childhood obesity and championed by Michelle Obama when she was First Lady. The Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, passed in 2010, required schools to reduce the calories, fat, sodium in foods served in cafeterias and increase offerings of whole grains, fruits, vegetables, and non-fat milk. The new regulations drew sharp criticism, however, and the Trump administration rolled back some of them, such as prohibition on 1% chocolate milk. But last year, the Biden administration proposed updates that would gradually limit salt and sugar in school lunch foods in an effort to meet federal dietary standards.
Thank you, Charlie. This story on the front page of The Current. During hours of testimony on the first day of the trial for Brandon Lettman this week, Ashley Spence's sisters scarcely stopped crying as they sat in the courtroom. The tears continued to fall as more and more witnesses were called to the stand to testify in Lettman's case Wednesday, nearly 8 years after 21-year-old Spence and 19-year-old Cameron Mounds Jr. were gunned down. Lettman, 31, is charged in connection with the death of Spence and Mounds in Hartford during the summer of 2016, following a scam trade of false drugs for a fake gun. The first witness called to the stand Wednesday, Desreen Taylor, told Senior Assistant State's Attorney Robin Krausik that on June 21, 2016, she rushed outside to find Spence shot in the driveway near her apartment on Enfield Street in the Hartford's North End. Taylor, who also wiped away tears from her seat on the witness stand, testified that she heard Spence's dying words. She said she remembered asking Spence what happened to her. "I got shot," she said, Spence replied. "That was the first time we ever heard that," said Autumn Spence, Spence's youngest sister, as she rapidly tried to wipe away the tears falling from her eyes outside the courtroom. "She broke my heart," she said. Spence's older sister, Trevana Sumlin, said the hardest part of the trial was having to live through some of the evidence. Although the shooting was 8 years ago and was considered a cold case until Lettman's arrest in 2019, Autumn Spence said, "It feels like yesterday." Spence's mother, LaTanya Sumlin, reached behind her to grip her daughter's hand as witnesses walked prosecutors through photos of the crime scene on Wednesday, showing the spot where Spence lay dying in the driveway. She was rushed to a hospital, but died on the way there, records show, while Mounds died at the scene. Lettman is accused of shooting both of them and injured a third person after he and Mounds both duped each other in a drug deal gone wrong. Mounds giving for, let me see if I have that right. Mounds, oh, sorry. I'm going to stop there, Charlie, and go over to you, okay?
Okay. All right, split court hints at some immunity for ex-presidents. If justices limit election case versus Trump, trial may come after November. The Supreme Court's conservative majority appeared ready on Thursday to rule that former presidents have some degree of immunity from criminal prosecution, a move that could further delay the criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump on charges that he plotted to subvert the 2020 election. Such a ruling would most likely send the case back to the trial court, ordering it to draw distinctions between official and private conduct. Though there was seeming consensus among the justices that the case could eventually go forward based on Mr. Trump's private actions, the additional proceedings could make it hard to conduct the trial before the 2024 election. There were only glancing references to the timing of the trial, no particular sense of urgency among the more conservative justices of Thursday's argument. Instead, several of them criticized what they suggested was a political prosecution brought under laws they said were ill-suited to the case at hand. If the court effectively blocks a prompt trial, particularly after it acted quickly in March to restore Mr. Trump to the ballot in California, or rather Colorado, it will surely ignite furious criticism from liberals and others who view the former president's actions as an assault on democracy and the rule of law.
Thank you, Charlie. And this story is on the front page of The Current. In what may have been an effort to save her job, Chief Public Defender Tashaun Bowden-Lewis argued through her lawyer Thursday that the oversight commission with which she has clashed for months lacks the authority to dismiss her. Attorney Thomas Bucci told the Public Defender Services Commission near the conclusion of a 40-minute argument that it is an error in thinking it can remove Bowden-Lewis. But just minutes earlier, he seemed to have undercut his argument by reading from state law that gives the chief public defender authority to direct and supervise the division with the approval of the commission. Bucci said it is an erroneous concept that the commission has overarching authority over the chief public defender. Over 20 months in her position, Bowden-Lewis has fought with the Oversight Commission over her assertions that she has control over hiring, policy, and spending at the agency that represents the indigent, and that she has been micromanaged and second-guessed because she is black. Both claims were at the center of her lawyer argument on Thursday. Bucci was responding to a four-hour presentation earlier this month by the commission, in which it presented 16 charges of mismanagement against Bowden-Lewis that run from improperly accessing privileged email accounts in relating against those who disagree with her to repeatedly leveling unfounded allegations of racism. It is approximately 30 minutes past the top of the hour. Charlie and I will be back with more front pages after this message.
Hi, I'm Mario Cajar, a Chris Radio volunteer, inviting you to join the Connecticut Lions for their 17th annual Visually Impaired Persons Fishing Tournament. The Senior Division Tournament will be held Monday, May 20th, and again this year you'll be heading out to sea from Niantic aboard the Blackhawk Sport Fishing Charter, going for fluke, porgy, or whatever else is biting. Registration deadline for the Senior Division is April the 27th.
For more information and applications, call Laurie Satkowski at 860-250-4663. That's 860-250-4663. Or email Laurie at satkowski@sbcglobal.net.
Continuing with the international section of the New York Times, overwhelmed with visitors, Venice hands them the bill. Pulling into Santa Lucia train station in Venice on Thursday morning, passengers were told by an overhead announcement that they might have to pay a 5-euro fee to enter the city's historic center. Failure to pay could result in a fine from 50 to 300 euros, the announcement said. Outside the station, police officers in riot gear lingered while a flock of assistants in colorful safety vests stopped arriving travelers to ensure they had a QR code indicating that they'd registered to visit on a city website. Those who hadn't were directed to a booth where they could. After registering, overnight visitors were sent on their way without having to pay, but people planning to stay just for the day were charged, though there were some other exemptions. It was a new welcome to Venice, the first city in the world to charge visitors a nominal entrance fee, a measure city officials hope will counter over tourism. I only found out because my partner texted me this morning to say it was happening, said Lorraine Coulter, a hospital administrator from Rural England, in line at the booth. I thought he was joking. And she didn't think that people should have to pay for the privilege of seeing a beautiful city that everyone wants to visit, she said. Not far from the station, hundreds of protesters were making a lot of noise. For them, charging an entrance fee was a worrisome step in bringing Venice closer to what many fear the city will become if tides don't turn, a theme park. Blowing whistles, they handed out fake tickets reading, "Welcome to Venice Land." Some held signs saying, "Venice is not for sale," and "Stick it to the ticket," and chanted, "We want to take back our city." A ticket doesn't resolve over tourism, said Renata Maserai, a retired teacher from Venice who was among the protesters. Like other locals, she acknowledged that an influx of tourists, which last year reached nearly 20 million, could be a challenge. Often, she said, it involved physical collisions, including pointing accidents when you walk into a suddenly raised hand, or a photo accident where they back into you as they're looking into their phones. But the ticket, which applies only to day visitors arriving between 8:30 a.m. and 4 p.m., was ridiculous, she said. She added they could make more money charging for every cigarette butt that gets tossed on the ground. Venice is only one of dozens of cities, including Amsterdam, Athens, and Barcelona, grappling with a glut of tourists. Speaking in front of the In train station Thursday morning, the city's mayor, Luigi Brunaro, said that he'd been contacted by other places interested in the initiative, but he wouldn't say which ones for reasons of confidentiality. Floating on the water, crisscrossed with canals, Venice, which tradition says was founded in 421, though the date is debated, is exceptionally fragile. Last year, experts at UNESCO, the United Nations Cultural Agency, recommended it be put on the list of endangered World Heritage Sites, listing mass tourism as a main concern. Venice stayed off the danger list after the access fee was approved, but UNESCO officials said in a statement that further progress still needs to be made. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. The rest of our stories from The Current will come from the Connecticut section. State police have arrested a New London man in connection with a fiery rollover crash on the Gold Star Memorial Bridge in Groton last April that killed the driver of an oil tanker. Reginald Collins, 59, turned himself in Wednesday at the Troop E barracks on charges of negligent homicide with a motor vehicle, improperly parking on a highway, operating an unregistered motor vehicle, and operating without insurance, according to Connecticut State Police. He was initially held on a $25,000 bond and was arraigned the same day in New London Superior Court. A judge freed Collins on a promise to appear and continued the case until June 4th, according to court records. He did not enter a plea during the hearing, records show. According to the arrest warrant affidavit, Collins told investigators that he bought used tires for his Toyota Avalon on April 21st, 2023, around 10 a.m., and that at that time of the crash, around 11:20 a.m., was testing them. With a passenger in the vehicle, Collins said he was driving on Interstate 95 South on the bridge when the steering felt funny and the car began to jump, the warrant affidavit said. He said he moved across multiple lanes before he felt the tire let go, at which point he stopped in what state police described as the right acceleration lane on the bridge, according to the warrant affidavit. Collins and his passenger, both of whom suffered non-life-threatening injuries during the crash, got out of the Toyota and found that the tire was shredded, Collins told police. Shortly after the two got back into the car, the vehicle was struck by a 2001 Kenworth T300 oil tanker being driven by 42-year-old Wallace Fouquet III of Ledyard, according to state police. The tanker rolled over and caught fire on the bridge. Fouquet was killed in the crash. According to the warrant affidavit, investigation found that Collins' vehicle was not insured and its registration was suspended. Troopers alleged that despite the tire blowout, the car was capable of being driven and that Collins should have stopped in the shoulder instead of the right lane of I-95. Based on the investigations of the crash, it was found that the cause of the crash was that the operator of the Toyota Avalon created a traffic hazard by remaining stationary within the right acceleration lane and failing to move the vehicle out of the travel lane to a safe location, investigators wrote in the warrant affidavit. According to the warrant affidavit, state police could not determine if the tanker had any kind of mechanical issue because of its complete destruction. State police said they found that Falquette did not have the proper endorsement for transporting hazardous materials, the warrant affidavit said. Officials previously said the truck was carrying about 2,200 gallons of home heating oil, some of which ended up in the Thames River. However, troopers said they believe the lack of a hazardous materials endorsement does not negate the role that Collins had in failing to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk by stopping his vehicle in the right lane of I-95, the warrant affidavit said. Charlie?
Chinese-made drones popular with police face scrutiny by U.S. Fearing security risks, Congress may block purchase from DJI. The drones circled over the caves and crevices scattered around the mountain trails in northern Utah, feeding video back to a search team on the ground looking for a missing hiker. 19 minutes later, they had her coordinates, bringing the rescue, a drill, closer to the conclusion. In this kind of environment, that's actually pretty quick, said Kyle Nordforce, a volunteer search and rescue worker. He was operating one of the drones made by the Chinese company DJI, which dominates sales to law enforcement agencies as well as the hobbyist market in the United States. But if the DJI drones are a tool of choice for emergency responders around the country, they are widely seen in Washington as a national security threat. DJI is on a Defense Department list of Chinese military companies whose products the U.S. Armed Forces will be prohibited from buying in the future. As part of the defense budget that Congress passed this year, other federal agencies and programs are likely to be prohibited from buying DJI drones as well. The drones, though not designed or authorized for combat use, have also become ubiquitous in Russia's war against Ukraine. The Treasury and Commerce Departments have penalized DJI over the use of its drones for spying on Uyghur Muslims who are held in camps by Chinese officials in Xinjiang province. Researchers have found that Beijing could potentially exploit vulnerabilities in an app that controls the drone to gain access to large amounts of personal information, although a U.S. official said that there are currently no known vulnerabilities that have not been patched. Now Congress is weighing legislation that could kill much of DJI's commercial business in the United States by putting it on a Federal Communications Commission roster, blocking it from running on the country's communications infrastructure. The bill, which has bipartisan support, has met with a muscular lobbying campaign by DJI. The company is hoping that Americans like Mr. Nordforce, who use its products, will help persuade lawmakers that the United States has nothing to fear and much to gain by keeping DJI drones flying. But the influence campaign is facing a skeptical audience. DJI presents an unacceptable national security risk, and it's past time that drones made by communist China are removed from America, Representative Elise Stefanik, Republican of New York, said, and one of the bill's primary sponsors said in an emailed statement this month. Government agencies have shown that DJI drones are providing data on critical infrastructure in the United States to the Chinese Communist Party, Ms. Stefanik said, without elaborating. Any attempt to claim otherwise is a direct result of DJI's lobbying efforts. That bill would effectively ground DJI's drones, known as the Countering CCP Drones Act, which was passed unanimously by the House Energy and Commerce Committee last month. The legislation could come to a floor vote in the House in the next month or two, said a lobbyist and a China expert who'd been briefed on the plans as part of what they described as a planned China week during which a number of curbs on the country's business operations in the United States could be considered. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. At Geisler's freshly renovated Granby supermarket, customers find an eclectic mix of features, high-tech shopping carts, an elaborate Munson's Chocolates Corner, Connecticut and Massachusetts-grown produce, and an expanded deli and bakery section. The star of the show is the enormous kiosk where employees produce fresh popcorn in the traditional butter styles, as well as specialty flavors ranging from Oreo to bacon to blue raspberry. President Bob Rebick sees it all as part of how the Connecticut-based independent Geisler supermarket chain can compete as it begins its second century in business. Rebick said he and his brother Andrew, along with their cousins Ryan and Eric Nilsson, believe Geisler's will thrive against even its biggest rivals if it stays current with the ever-evolving marketplace where customer preferences change quickly. Part of that meant investing more than $1.5 million into completely redesigning the roughly 30,000-square-foot Granby store, and town and state officials have been invited to a ribbon-cutting celebration on May 4th at 9 a.m. Some of the new layout came from what Rebick learned when the chain renovated its outlet in Agawam, Massachusetts, and some of it was designed specifically for the Granby market. "I learned that putting the fresh foods forward is really where our industry is going," Rebick said Wednesday, as he showed visitors the produce section, an expanded showcase of grab-and-go store-prepared meals. "We're competing less and less with each other and more with restaurants. Over half of the food consumed in the U.S. is restaurant food, whether that's takeout or in the restaurant." Between January 2nd and earlier this month, construction workers installed new flooring, rearranged aisles and shelves, took out drop ceilings, installed more decorative lighting, and added a much wider entryway with better natural light. But beyond the structure itself, Geisler's has been putting money into high-volume, state-of-the-art bakery ovens and other kitchen equipment to supply the extensive offerings of prepared, prepackaged lunches and dinners that Geisler's staff turns out each day. Charlie?
Energy Department makes a push to speed up permits to expand electric grids. The Biden administration yesterday finalized a rule meant to speed up federal permits for major transmission lines, part of a broader push to expand America's electric grids. Administration officials are increasingly worried that their plans to fight climate change could falter unless the nation can quickly add vast amounts of grid capacity to handle more wind and solar power and to better tolerate extreme weather. The pace of construction for high-voltage power lines has sharply slowed since 2013, and building new lines can take a decade or more because of permitting delays and local opposition. The Energy Department is trying to use the limited tools at its disposal to pour roughly $20 billion into grid upgrades and to streamline approvals for new lines. But experts say a rapid large-scale grid expansion may ultimately depend on Congress. Under the rule announced on Thursday, the Energy Department would take over as the lead agency in charge of federal environmental reviews for certain interstate power lines and would aim to issue necessary permits within 2 years. Currently, the federal approval process can take 4 years or more and often involves multiple agencies each conducting their own separate reviews. "We need to build new transmission projects more quickly, as everybody knows," Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said. "The new reforms are a huge improvement from the status quo, where developers routinely have to navigate several independent permitting processes throughout the federal government." The permitting changes would only affect lines that require federal review, like those across federally owned lands. Such project made up 20% of all transmission line miles added between 2010 and 2020. To qualify, developers would need to create a plan to engage with the public much earlier in the process. Experts said that the change could be significant for power lines in the West, where the federal government owns nearly half the land and permitting can be arduous. It took developers 17 years to win approval for one major line known as SunZia that was designed to connect an enormous wind farm in New Mexico to homes and businesses in Arizona and California. It's now 45 minutes after the hour, and that means that Bill and I will be right back in, well, just about a minute.
Sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, is the leading cause of death among infants. There are ways to help reduce the risk of SIDS and other sleep-related causes of infant death. Always put babies to sleep on their backs during every sleep time. Lay babies to sleep on a firm sleep surface covered by a fitted sheet. Put babies to sleep in a separate sleep area in the same room next to where you sleep. To learn more, call 1-800-505-CRIB.
Continuing with the national section of the New York Times, Tennessee parents question if teachers should carry guns. From Franklin, Tennessee, Devin Dixon believes guns serve a purpose. That's why she's licensed to carry and conceal firearms. She's also a mother living in the Nashville suburbs with three school-aged children. She worries about their safety, especially after 3 9-year-olds were among the 6 killed in a school shooting in the city last year. It's pretty heavy on my heart, she said. But those concerns weren't enough to persuade Ms. Dixon that Tennessee lawmakers were right to pass a bill on Tuesday that would allow teachers and other school employees to carry concealed handguns on campus in an effort to protect students. She confessed that she didn't know what the solution to securing schools was. She suspected that lawmakers didn't either. Everyone is grasping at straws because no one has the answers, Ms. Dixon, 38, said. The fear and fury unleashed by the shooting at the Convent School, a private academy in Nashville, has fueled a concerted push from parents at the school, as well as many others across the state, to urge lawmakers to act. Legislators responded with a concealed carry measure, which has been one of the most significant bills to emerge after the shooting, following roughly 20 other states that enacted some version of legislation that allows teachers to be armed. Even in a state as conservative as Tennessee, the reaction to the bill has included unease and disappointment. The skepticism has come not just from those who want tighter restrictions on firearms, but also from some who generally believe strongly in gun rights. Their reluctance was rooted in doubts about the wisdom of placing such a daunting responsibility on teachers and other school workers. 4 Republicans broke party ranks in the state house and voted against the measure, which still passed by an overwhelming margin. I'm concerned the bill, even though its intent is to make schools safer, might in fact complicate the logistics of neutralizing an active shooter, said State Representative Charlie Baum, one of the Republicans who voted against the bill. In the 13 months since the shooting, the aftermath has been in many ways echoed the familiar contours of debates over gun safety and that have risen after deadly mass shootings, including after the attack in an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas in 2022. In Tennessee, the parents of students who survived met with lawmakers, relaying the pain and horror caused by the attack in deeply personal terms. Protesters also flooded the state capitol, and 2 Democratic lawmakers made national news when they were expelled for bringing the demonstration to the House floor. The Republican supermajority rebuffed those demands, even resisting Tennessee Republican Governor Bill Lee, who backed a measure that would allow guns to be taken away from individuals deemed a threat to themselves or others. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. A Connecticut woman planning medical leave from her job in order to undergo a hysterectomy was allegedly harassed by her supervisor and co-workers, who taunted her about whether she was having a sex change operation, according to a lawsuit. The woman was ultimately terminated from her job at Chase Family Movement Disorder Center in Vernon, according to her lawsuit against Hartford Healthcare, which owns the center. The woman, an East Hartford resident, is claiming sexual orientation discrimination and hostile work environment against Hartford Healthcare. According to the complaint, the woman was scheduled for a surgery in June 2023, was told by her supervisor to apply for leave under the Family and Medical Leave Act. Before her leave began, she told her supervisor that her wife would be taking care of her after her surgery. Her supervisors responded by asking her whether she was a lesbian, the suit states. Later, the supervisor asked the woman, "Are you sure you won't be out for a sex change?" it states. According to the suit, other employees asked the woman about a sex change or said the supervisor had told them that the woman was getting a sex change. Plaintiff denied to co-workers and to the supervisor that she was getting a sex change and complained that she found the comments hurtful and upsetting, the suit said. It continues that the woman suffered from anxiety and depression based on the comments and from discrimination because she was a lesbian. While she was on leave, the woman received a letter informing her that her FMLA leave was denied, the suit states. When she returned to work on August 7th, co-workers continued to discriminate against and harass the plaintiff, the suit claims, and continuing to ask about her alleged sex change. Comments allegedly included, "How does it feel to be a dude? We thought you were the girl in the mirrors, not the guy." And asking the woman whether she was manly because of her rumored sex change, according to the complaint. The woman became very upset and responded, "I am not a man," again asking for the harassment to stop, the suit states. Her supervisor told her that co-workers felt they were walking on eggshells and felt weird around her because of the alleged sex change and because she was a lesbian, according to the complaint. The woman asked her supervisor to tell employees she had not had a sex change operation and to stop harassing her, the suit states. Instead, the supervisor arranged for her to be transferred to a different location. The woman says she did not want to be transferred, the suit states. Charlie?
Behind a vegan chef's empire, a trail of chaos and bounced checks. Josie Duran overheard Matthew Kenny's pitch many times. As a lead server at Plant Food and Wine in Venice Beach, California, Ms. Duran often waited on Mr. Kenny, the restaurant chef and owner, as he entertained potential investors on the restaurant's fig tree-shaded patio, persuading them to trust him with their money for his ambitious culinary projects. At a time when adopting a plant-based diet has become an environmental and ethical cause around the world, Mr. Kenny, 59, is among the world's most famous vegan chefs. Plant Food was the flagship restaurant of Matthew Kenny Cuisine, a sprawling health-focused company that until recently operated or managed or invested in more than 50 restaurants across the globe from Los Angeles to Sao Paulo to Dubai. But Ms. Duran grew to resent Mr. Kenny's visits because, in part, she said she believed she was helping the chef cultivate a misleading image of success. "I just knew the investors were investing in a lost cause, and I couldn't say anything," Ms. Duran said. Ms. Duran, who worked at the restaurant from 2021 until she quit early last year, "I would have my check bounced for the fifth pay period in a row, and Matthew Kenny would be presenting to them how amazing Plant Food Plus and Wine is doing. In fact, Plant Food, which just relocated to the Four Seasons Hotel in July, closed in January, the latest of at least 17 restaurants associated with Mr. Kenny that have shuttered since late 2021. Ms. Duran is one of more than 60 former employees, jilted investors, and frustrated business associates who told the New York Times of a 30-year pattern of chaotic and reckless management by Mr. Kenny, marked by businesses that opened to positive press and then closed, often quickly and amid a flurry of lawsuits, unpaid bills, and bounced paychecks. They said Mr. Kenny has been able to persist despite repeated failures to meet his financial obligations in part because of his prominent role since the mid-2000s in promoting vegan cooking. Many investors and employees said that they were willing to overlook financial warning signs and excuse his past failures because of their devotion to animal rights and mindful nutrition. Bill.
Thank you, Charlie. And our last story is actually a theater review from the Hartford Stage. Hartford Stage offers a milder, more mellifluous Arthur Miller with a remarkable gentle All My Sons. There are two general ways to attempt revivals of Miller plays these days, epic or naturalistic. Originally, they were something in between. Miller was more attuned to the late 19th century domestic realism of Ibsen and Chekhov than he was to the method acting trend of the mid-20th century when he wrote most of his classics. We got a touch of the epic style earlier this year when the Long Wharf Theater did a View from the Bridge with portentous, sharply lit tableaus, dialogue rendered as grand speeches in a ubiquitous Greek chorus of dock workers. Harpin stages rendition of 1946 All My Sons, running through May 5th, takes the realistic route, which is a sound choice for director and Harpin stage artistic director Melissa Bensussen, but comes with some clear pitfalls. For Bensussen, it's a style that comes naturally and one which Hartford stage audiences saw when she directed a different family-based drama by a different Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and longtime Connecticut resident Eugene O'Neill's Ah, Wilderness in 2021. Her efforts to make stagier statements more intimate and playable were also evident in her 2022 Hartford stage production of Shakespeare's A Winter's Tale. She's able to set and maintain a low-key tone that keeps the tragic elements from becoming overdone Greek tragedy. This restrained take on material that is often played with incendiary zeal is welcome but not always sustainable. Miller's script is very much of its time, a mid-20th century melodrama with a lot of baggage. At its best, it still carries great emotional weight. At worst, it can get as stilted and stodgy as a 1940s black and white movie. I'm going to tell you when it's playing, where you can see it. All My Sons by Arthur Miller, directed by Melissa Bensussen, runs through May 5th at the Hartford Stage. It's on 50 Church Street in Hartford. Here are the performance times: Wednesdays and Thursdays at 7:30 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., Saturdays at 2 and 8 p.m.